Okay, we start with the second part of the session, and I'd like to introduce Steve Luker.
Thanks. Unfortunately, I think I dropped my mic. Oh, it's working now? Oh, good.
Is this one still working?
Yeah. It just doesn't work.
Well, I can put that transmitter in the pocket with my cell phone and really annoy people. All right. So, case studies and resolution validation and whatever. So, towards the end of this talk, I'll get to the question that Tom asked the other day about the IP3 receptor and why we didn't apply the gold standard to it. We have. So that'll be sort of the second half of the talk. But what I want to do for much of the talk is actually look at some of the structures that have been published in the NCMI over the last few years, and we've gone back and sort of reevaluated them using the gold standard or something somewhat equivalent to the gold standard, and just sort of see how things pan out and how much of a problem there really is or isn't, depending on the specific case. So you've seen this two times now. I'm going to do it a third time, and maybe it'll sink in with everyone the third time. I'll give my own little take on it. So the different methods for determining resolution. Right? So this is the method that many people have used over the last decade or so. You just refine all of your data together, and at the very end, you split it into two halves, you compute separate reconstructions. Note I didn't say independent reconstructions, but separate reconstructions. You compute an FSC between them, and that gives you your resolution curve. And there are all sorts of things that can go wrong with this process, including noise bias and model bias and masking artifacts and all sorts of other things. And, sort of the historical feeling was that if you had a healthy-looking FSC curve, it started at 1 and it went down to 0, and it stayed down at 0, that you were probably okay. And certainly that's not the case. But that was sort of the standard in the field for a while. Now, we can take one step slightly better than this, and this is what we've done in EMAN over the years, which is we get to the end, we split it into even and odd halves, and then we redetermine 3 out of the 5 orientation parameters before we compute the 3D structure. And the idea was that this might buy us a little bit more independence between the structures, and it does. It buys a little more independence between the structures, but not enough to really fix the problem. So then we get to this next idea, which I sort of attribute to Nico, I think, which is that if you don't, you can split your data at the beginning, you low-pass filter your starting model so it doesn't have any high-resolution information, and then you do the independent refinements, but you don't include the high-resolution data. And Richard just talked about this, too. So you exclude the high-resolution data from your data, and you exclude the high-resolution data from the starting models, but otherwise the starting models are the same. Now, this approach can work in some cases. The problem with this approach comes in if you go back and forth between Fourier space and real space a lot. So, you're all working in CryWAM, you're all probably familiar with Fourier transforms one way or another, right? So if you work completely in Fourier space and don't ever do anything in real space, then things are very self-consistent, you tend not to build up artifacts. But when you go between Fourier space and real space, artifacts will build up in one way or another. So if you ever want to do anything like solvent flattening, in other words, something involving some sort of a mask, even if you're very careful about it, you do a very, very slowly varying mask and you try not to put any high-resolution artifacts, if you're using this model where you throw away all of the high-resolution data from your model and you throw away all the high-resolution information from your data, then what's going to come in at high resolution is masking artifacts and that sort of thing, and it will give you some bias in your reconstruction and can make your resolution look better than it actually is. So this is a perfect test, but only in some very limited situations, which certainly don't apply for what we do in EMAN. It may apply in FreeAlign. I don't know, do you ever mask stuff?
During refinement.
During refinement.
Yeah, no.
No, okay. So...
No, I do, actually.
Okay. All right, well, anyway.
Not so badly.
Not so badly, okay. So then the real sort of gold standard then would be you split the data at the beginning, you use different starting models, which aren't just low-pass filtered. They're phase randomized beyond some resolution, and then you do independent refinements And I say the caveat here that you don't have to limit the resolution that you're including at this point. You're using different starting models, and if they converge at high resolution to the same point eventually, then you can reasonably trust that that's real and not an artifact. Now, this is susceptible to a few problems as well. You know, you can still get some noise bias working in, and Richard spent a while discussing that in the last slide. But still, it's orders of magnitude better than what we were doing up here, or even up here. So, you know, there's still some possibilities for doing things. I can give you one example, just so people don't ever do this. If you take your reconstructions, your two independent reconstructions, and you over-filter them, you low-pass filter them a lot, and then you impose a mask, even if it's a really soft mask, then what you'll see is correlations between the mask, because you've gotten rid of all the high-resolution information from your structure. So any sort of residual artifacts that you put in there will correlate very well. So you can take a structure that's, you know, 8 angstrom resolution, and you can make it look like it's 4 angstrom resolution by filtering it to 15 angstroms and masking. Okay, so you sort of have to make sure that the level of detail visible in your structure is consistent with the resolution that you've achieved and shares use a Wiener filter while you're refining between the models. That fairly nicely takes care of that problem as well. But there are a few things you still have to be careful about. So, all right, so that was just what I was saying there. So next thing I want to do is I'm just going to go through a few structures that we have and talk about how, you know, what we get when we sort of really reliably assess the resolution rather than using the old style method. Now, Hua already spent a lot of time talking about epsilon 15. I'm not going to go through his whole set of slides again or anything like that. I'm going to just make a couple of subtle modifications to what he said, or enhancements to what he said. So there is the structure. It looks very nice. You know, you can resolve the beta strands in the sheet. Alpha helices all fit nicely. We're beginning to see some large side chains, you know, that sort of thing. So there's no question it's a very nice structure. Now, what Hua showed was we actually had done 2 completely independent data sets. We collected data on the Joule 3000 6 or 7 years ago at liquid helium temperatures and collected a full data set, and we refined that to some resolution. And then more recently, we collected another data set about the same size on the Joule 3200 at nitrogen temperatures using the energy filter and all of the modern improvements. And he showed you these 2 curves. He showed you an FSC curve comparing the old structure to the new structure using all of the data. And he showed you a curve which compared even and odd halves using a gold standard resolution test on just the new data set. And he said, oh, look, they match very nicely. And that's true, they do match very nicely, but they really shouldn't match very nicely. The curve here, you actually were comparing 2 full data sets. You had twice as much data in the blue curve. So really, you would have expected that blue curve to be a little bit better than the red curve, not actually stop there. And you'll note also that at low resolution, there's a little bit of a gap there. I mean, now that's not very significant, but, you know, there are some slight differences. Now, you know, the question is, why is that true? I would argue that probably it's just the fact that the epsilon that we looked at 6 or 7 years ago isn't exactly the same. It's not the same prep. It's, you know, not the same conditions. Everything's a little bit different, and those subtle differences are probably enough that it's not improving past that point. Now, if we use the old style resolution test on this data set, well, I didn't show this curve. So that's the curve that we used when we first published, you know, long before there were any discussion about these gold standard tests years ago. And back then we were using the 0.5 criteria for this. So if we look at the resolution here versus the resolution here, they're pretty much the same. I mean, there's a slight exaggeration. You know, we said 4.3, not 4.5, but I think this is still a reasonable level of agreement. Now, I'm not arguing that means that if you use the 0.5 criterion with the old test, that's a substitute for doing the gold standard test. I don't want people to get that impression. It happens to work out pretty reliably, as we'll see. If you aren't overfitting your data, then that will work out pretty well. You know, the 0.5 criterion with the old test and the gold standard test at the 0.143 will tend to agree pretty closely with each other. But if you are overfitting, then they won't agree at all. And we'll get to that, and you can see it. All right, next structure, BMV. This is a fairly new project in the lab. It hasn't been published yet, but we'll take a quick look at it anyway. So this is a very small virus. It's a plant virus. It's only about 250 angstroms across, 300 angstroms across. It's much smaller than the typical virus particle. This data set was collected on the Joule 3200, 300 kilovolts. This was collected on the 4K CCD. This was before we got the newer detectors. Well, you can see the other parameters here. So about 12,000, 13,000 particles. Here's the structure. You can see there's a small beta sheet right here that we can resolve the strands in the beta sheet. We can see some little lumps coming out on the structure. We can zoom in here. We can see that we're beginning to see some big side chains sticking out on the side. I'm not making any really strong statements about this. This is all preliminary. It's not published yet. But there are lumps there which seem to be in about the right place. It's better than 5 angstrom resolution, certainly, but where does it fall? Okay, so here's the results. This time I'm showing you the gold standard FSC first. Well, I guess I did that last time, too. So here's the gold standard FSC curves. Now, there's two of them. One of them is for the raw overall volume, and then the red one is for doing the additional non-crystallographic symmetry averaging of the subunits, and then measuring the resolution of the subunits. Now, that is a little tricky to do, because if you want to average subunits together, you have to put a mask around them, and then that mask can sometimes exaggerate your resolution a little bit. So you have to look at those curves with a few caveats, but I think we did it fairly carefully in this case. And that says that if we average all the subunits, we can get down to about 3.9, and the overall structure is about 4.6. And I would say that pretty much jibes with what you see in the actual structure, right? Strand separation, a few big side chains. That's kind of what you'd expect at this resolution. Now, if we look at the old style resolution criteria, the non-gold standard one, now there are three curves here. I'm trying to remember what he did. Oh, in one case, the green curve here, I think he did not mask out the stuff inside the capsid. And in the blue curve, he had masked out the inside of the capsid, and you can see it made relatively little difference in the actual curves. But once again, here you can see the resolution from the 0.5 criterion with the old standard was about 3.8, and now we're claiming about 3.9 or 4.4 versus 4.6. So more or less the same again. So these are examples of cases where it works out reasonably nicely, where there was no bias. And I would say this will tend to happen pretty frequently with virus particles because they have very high symmetry, they have high mass. Determining the orientations accurately is, it's usually going to be driven by the data. Noise bias is less likely to become severe. I'm not saying that you can trust in that fact and you shouldn't do the gold standard test. You still should do the gold standard test. But, okay. Another example. Molluscan hemocyanin. So people have probably seen various hemocyanins before, and there are lots of different overall conformations you can find hemocyanin. This is a gigantic hemocyanin. This particular hemocyanin is about 8 megadaltons. It has D5 symmetry. It looks kind of like a giant Grolier particle in a sense. It's 5 instead of 7, but it looks kind of like a giant Grolier particle. Each of the 10 symmetric, 10 unit cells has two chains in it. It's a homodimer. And each of those chains is subdivided into 8 functional units along the length of the chain. So if we look at the architecture a little bit in the channel, I'll go back to that in a second. So you look at the architecture. So here is one of the asymmetric units, and you can see these color-coded things, the different functional units along the length of the chain. And the functional units have about 45% sequence identity among them. The question looking at the structure was, how do the functional units interact, and how do you they act cooperatively to promote oxygen binding, that sort of thing. So this is, this is a very large structure. It's not quite a virus, but the amount of symmetry is pretty high. Now, the nice thing about this structure is that since we have two identical chains and they run in opposite directions, so you can see the green one down here and then the green one up here, that means that we can compare the equivalent portions of each of the chains independently. So we can chop out the two functional units from each unit cell, and we can compare them. And what you'd probably expect to see is that the green ones should agree pretty well, but not as well as you'd expect, say, the purple ones to agree. The purple ones are playing pretty much the same role in the structure, whereas the green ones, one's in the middle and is binding to its counterpart in the other other half of the ring, whereas the other green one is sort of dangling off in space. So we did that test. So we compared, we'll look at a little structure first. All right, so here's the structure, zooming in a little bit so you can see what sort of level of detail. Once again, you can see that we've got the strands in the beta sheet fairly well resolved. We can see some big side chains sticking off the side. See this big mass where the link is occurring between the channels. So it's a very nice structure. And again, this is a structure that's sort of the better than 5 angstrom regime. If we look at the raw data, this was a slide I passed by before. You can see that we have pretty nice ripples in the contrast transfer function out past 4 angstroms. So there really is some signal there that we're reconstructing, and we're not, at least not completely fooling ourselves in anything. Okay, so now this structure was first solved before the discussions about gold standard curves were occurring last year. So this structure was first done about a year and a half ago, something like that. But they've been interpreting it since then. It takes a little while to get some of these things out. So what I've got here is not a gold standard curve. What I have here is something which is kind of like the gold standard curve. We have a comparison between the first chain and second chain functional units as we sort of work our way alternately down the chain, right? So we compare A in the first subunit to A in the second subunit, H in the first, H to the second. So H were these subunits down here, and the A subunits are the ones that are sort of adjacent to each other in the structure. I think the color coding may be off, but that's what's going on here. Actually, I don't have it right. Sorry, it's not the A, it's the D. The one that actually is at the highest resolution are the ones that are adjacent in the structure. So you can compare all these different ones, and we see pretty much what we would have expected to see. We can see that the resolution, the comparison between the two which are not in functionally equivalent positions is the worst, and the best ones are the ones which are adjacent in the structure. And if we look at that, and we use sort of, the 0.143 criteria there. Now, actually, you probably shouldn't use 0.143 here. We should actually use something more like 0.33, because this was done with all of the data in the map. We didn't subdivide it in half. So we have to be, somewhere in between. So we can have debates about what the various criteria should be. But if you subdivide your data into halves, and both halves are noisy data, then Richard's argument about the 1.143 criterion can be made. If you don't subdivide your data, if you take away any one of those things, then you go to sort of 0.33, and if you take away two of those things, then you have to go all the way up to 0.5. But that's kind of a subtle point. We get about 4.3 angstrom resolution here, and again, if we look at the old resolution test with the 0.5 criterion, again, it's somewhere in sort of the same general neighborhood, around 4.5 angstroms. Now, we are actually running the gold standard refinement on this structure, but it takes a long time to run, so it isn't quite complete yet. Okay, so I'm just running through the structures really fast here. No biology, just what you expect to see. All right, so now I thought we'd take a step back in resolution a little bit. So this is a project that I did in collaboration with Chris Akey's group. He collected the data on his microscope, and then I worked on the processing of the data. So this data was collected on an F20, run at 160 kilovolts, because he thinks that gives him the best data on his particular F20. It was sampled at 1.7 angstroms per pixel. This is a D8 symmetric object. It's two back-to-back 8-membered rings, but they're flattened rings. It's not like Roiel that's this cylinder. It's it's kind of flattened. You'll see it in a second. So these are the side views right here. And you can see the top views, since it's very thin, the top views are somewhat faint. So you can count the 8-fold symmetry there, but so the data is reasonably good. The contrast is high. It's about 2.5 megadaltons. And the final structure, we haven't seen it yet, but there was homology modeling done to build an atomistic model into it. So here's the structure. We'll sort of rock it back and forth there. Now, one of the really nice things about the structure, one of the reasons I like to use it as an example, is the central portion of the structure. Let me pause this movie in the middle. There. So the central part of the structure, this entire domain is almost entirely alpha helical. There's like one beta sheet in the middle there, but it's almost entirely alpha helices. Then out here in the periphery, there are two beta propellers. So the beta structures, which would be the sort of the hardest to resolve, are the ones that are farthest from the center and the place where you're most likely to have blurring. So moving forward, I think this, you know, apoptosomes are actually really nice test specimens because of this sort of feature. Now, we're not at the resolution in this structure where we can resolve the strands in the beta sheet, but we are at the resolution where we can begin to resolve the propellers in the beta propeller. So here's one monomer extracted from the structure, and I'm sorry I don't have any really pretty movies from this. I just put these together really quickly a day or so ago. And you can see that the alpha helices match extremely nicely, and the beta propeller domains, they match pretty well. You can see that you know, the shape of the sheets actually matches pretty nicely in most cases. And you know, overall, it's a pretty nice structure. So what resolution is this structure at? What resolution does anyone think? Anyone want to shout out a guess?
Eight.
Yeah. Good. Okay, good guess. So when we published this structure, we claimed a resolution using the old criteria of 6.9, and it wasn't exactly the curve I'm showing here. It was, you know, slightly different. But, you know, so the old resolution test is the blue curve, and at 0.5, that came out to be about 7. And if you use the gold standard curve, it comes out to be about 7.8. So this is a case where the two numbers don't agree exactly. And the risk here is, of course, if you said that it was 7, not 7.8, you might be tempted to filter a little bit less and bring up a little bit of that stuff, which is really noise, but probably wouldn't look like noise if you do it subtly enough. So, the difference with what?
Infiltration.
Yes.
Directly at the seeker.
Yes.
Filters, as we discussed.
Yes.
The difference would be large in effect.
That's true. Yes. If you use the FSC curve using the blue curve in its individual split form, if you use that to compute a filter, you're right. The filter would be noticeable. The difference in filtration. That's what I meant. The difference in the filtration between the black curve and the blue curve would be noticeable if you computed one that way, yes. It wouldn't be all that noticeable, honestly, though. I mean, I've done it, and it looks bigger than it really is, right? I mean, you're talking about a 0.8 angstrom resolution difference. It's not that. Anyway, so that's one structure. And you'll notice I put the acknowledgments up in front of each one, because if I put all the acknowledgments together in the end for each of these structures, it turns into about 20 slides at once, and that's no one wants to read that. So, most of the rest of the talk, I'm going to spend talking about this IP3 receptor structure. So this has been sort of a long-standing collaboration between Arina Sarasheva's lab and Hua and myself. Long ago, Susan Hamilton's group was actually involved as well. She was mostly on the calcium release channel side. So I'll go into a little bit more detail on this project, since it's sort of the primary counterexample. As I said, this was the talk I gave earlier this year that Tom wasn't aware of when he complained that I hadn't used the gold standard on it, where I just sort of fell on my sword and said, well, look, we overestimated the resolution, but the structure is mostly right anyway. So we've got these two families of calcium release channels. Okay, so we have in the SR membrane in muscle tissue, we've got the ryanodine receptors, also known as calcium release channel, which releases the big bursts of calcium which cause muscle contraction. And if you look in the ER membrane, you'll find these IP3 receptors. And the IP3 receptors are found in basically all ER membranes, and they're involved in a wide variety of anything, pretty much anything that involves calcium signaling involves these IP3 receptors in some fashion. And interestingly, you can actually see, if you look at muscle tissue, you can actually see some crosstalk between these two systems. The effect is somewhat localized in the cell, but you can actually see influence on, if you have a defect in the IP3 receptor, you can actually see influence on muscle function and vice versa. So the calcium release channel structure was first solved almost 20 years ago now. And that has a fairly known structure, and we solved two groups ourselves, and one other group solved a higher resolution version of the structure about 6 or 7 years ago. And that one wasn't ever all that contentious. All of the structures of this channel have more or less agreed. In the very early days, there were some subtle disagreements about some internal features, but those were resolved in 1994 or something like that. So this isn't a very contentious structure. The IP3 receptor has been much more of a problem. And Tom showed this example the other day, right? So the IP3 receptor, several maps were published. This is three. There was technically a fourth one as well, which for some reason we don't have. But three maps were published of the IP3 receptor back in 2002, 2003. More or less at the same time, and all the groups were aware each other were working on the project, which is why these were all sort of rushed to publication, right? Because everyone was competing, no one wanted to get scooped by anyone else. None of them look at all like each other in any way. And of course, the middle structure was our structure. I will proudly take credit for a horrible mistake. Each of these groups firmly believed that their structure was correct and the other structures were wrong. Well, the reality of the situation is none of us were right. So here's the structure that we published just last year, a year before last year, something like that. So Arena basically spent 6 years working on the biochemical purification. So she's now doing she's running a immunity purification. She has a good antibody for it. She can pull it down very nicely. It's basically a one-step purification. Well, I mean, you have to run your sucrose gradient, but it's one step in the column purification. She can get it on ice without any carbon substrate, and the data has improved dramatically. And I'll show you how we can judge that as well. But we got this lovely looking map. Now, one of the problems here is, of course, this map doesn't look as lovely as a lot of other structures. It looks kind of lumpy. It looks kind of like it's been underfiltered, right? So what's going on with that? This seems to be sort of a general feature in a lot of integral membrane protein structures that you see. There's a lot of strangeness in the map. Now, part of that can be attributed to the fact that they're detergent solubilized. These aren't reconstituted in liposomes or something like that. There's all the detergent floating around in solution. And particularly in the transmembrane domain, right, you've got this blob of detergent, which is kind of random, sticking onto the particle. And that causes some difficulties when you're trying to determine orientations and stuff. Another interpretation is that we probably overestimated the resolution a little bit. We'll get into that. So let's take a look at some of the raw data. And let me convince you that maybe the structure, at least in general, is right first. So the data on the left, it doesn't look terrific up on the monitor there, but you can probably tell that there's something in here, right? You can see that there's a particle here, there's a particle down here, there's a particle over here with another one right next to it there. But there's also all these black specks floating around, and clearly there's a sort of a strong background present in the images. So, you know, if you looked at that, you'd say, well, I am seeing particles, right? And if you didn't have anything better than that, you'd probably still analyze it or try to analyze it, right? Now, here's the current data set. And you can see in this data set, hopefully it looks okay up there, that the particles are very well defined. You can see the shape of each individual particle as it's floating around in ice. There's no question about what you're boxing out when you're pulling particles out of this data. So just by eye, the quality has certainly improved considerably over the old data set. Nonetheless, that's you know, not sufficient proof, obviously. We need to do some sorts of validations, particularly since these three structures were published before and they disagreed, and now we're saying that they're all wrong. Okay, so the first check we'll always do is a self-consistency check. Now, this does not prove that you have the right structure, but if this comes out wrong, then you know you don't have the right structure, right? So necessary but insufficient condition. So we make projections, and we look at class averages, and we look at reference-free class averages, and then we actually may look at some raw particles, too, and we make sure that this all looks, just by eye, somewhat self-consistent. You can do it numerically. You can compute numbers comparing this to this as well, but it doesn't accomplish a whole lot. Generally, you're just trying to ensure that they have pretty much the same shape. Now, of course, the problem with this approach is that we did this similar sort of test when we published the original paper as well. So here are the class averages on the top, and here are projections of the structure on the bottom. So, you know, it doesn't look as nice as the new one, certainly, but, you know, at the time, we were only claiming, you know, 30 angstrom resolution or something. You know, it didn't seem to disagree too badly, so, yeah, anyway. All right, validation. So what methods can we use to validate the structure? So here are the four I'm going to talk about today. So you can do a random conical tilt structure of your your molecule. So we did that. So we collected tilt data. I think we used 45 degree tilt. So we did collected tilt data for the specimen. We did a reconstruction, and we got this tremendously beautiful blob. And we imposed four-fold symmetry, of course. So not only is it just a blob, it's a blob where the major feature was achieved by imposing the symmetry. So this didn't disagree with our results, but I wouldn't say it was stellar evidence that the structure was correct either. All right, so the next thing we decided to do was invert the problem and use Richard's tilt validation on it. Okay, so this is the same basic experiment, but instead of doing a 45-degree tilt, we just did a 15-degree tilt or a 10-degree tilt. And then you box out the pairs, and you do pretty much exactly what Richard just described, right? You find the orientations of each particle independently from the two micrographs, and then you compare the orientations to the known amount of tilt that that occurred when you did the experiment. And then you make a little plot. And we make a plot, and oh, look, we get, you know, we get one nice, pretty tight cluster in this data. Now, I can zoom in on that. You can actually see the little distribution. And the point is actually focused on the correct tilt angle, and it's in the basically the correct tilt direction. It's of course, off a little bit, but it's all within the limits of the error in the data set. Now, we decided, okay, this is fine. It's a reasonable cluster. It's got a little more spread than we'd like it to have, but it's at least a cluster. What would happen if we took the new data and we tried to validate the previously published structures? Okay, so we did that. So we took each of the three previously published structures and we used the new data, and you can see absolutely no clustering anywhere. It's just complete rubbish. So we consider this pretty solid evidence that now, of course, each of these structures was done using different data. You know, you could argue that, well, maybe there was some biochemical difference in the prep or something like that, and we can't argue against that possibility. This was using our data against someone else's structure, so it's not entirely a fair test, but we can certainly say that our data does not support any of the previous structures, and it does pretty strongly support the new structure. And I can tell you some theories for exactly what went wrong in each of these cases. I mean, in our case, we had some model bias getting into the refinement, and it was over 10 years ago. You know, it just wasn't really on the radar at the time. I mean, we were a little suspicious about it, but we convinced ourselves that it was right. This structure, I'm pretty convinced what happened is, so think about something that's shaped like this. Okay, it has pretty strong density in the center, and then if you're looking in projection, it has weaker densities on the periphery. Right, any sort of structure that's shaped like a mushroom is going to do that. It's going to have strong density in summation through the middle. That's going to have weaker densities in the periphery. So think what happens as the noise level rises in your images. As the noise level gets higher and higher, the first thing to sort of fade out from usable contrast is this stuff in the periphery because it has lower value and you're just adding sort of constant noise to the image. So what eventually you end up with is just sort of the blob, which is kind of the core of the structure, and you lose this peripheral information. And you say, well, yeah, but if you can align the core, then you should get that peripheral information back. It's kind of true, but that assumes that you can align the core properly. And you probably can't, and your angular accuracy goes down as the information, the radius of the information that you're including goes down. So I suspect what happened here is that they probably did an okay purification, but the data was just too noisy to process. Now, a notable thing about all three of these publications is no one published any of their raw data in the
papers.
Remember
the raw data, the original paper that from
there was one image. Yeah.
Yeah, I cannot see anything.
That's right. Yes, it looks like just pure noise to my eye as well. We asked for some of the data at some point, you know, much later after the furor had died down, and you didn't want to share it. It's okay. The other structure, I can't tell you exactly what happened, and this is just a theory too. I mean, I don't really know what happened, but in any case, I'm pretty confident that the new structure is right in general. Then, of course, the other question is whether it's got the right resolution, and we're getting there. Okay, so the tilt validation, you know, it confirms the quaternary structure, gives you a rough assessment of particle orientation. People have suggested you could also use it as a tool for sort of eliminating bad particles. You know, if you take tilt pairs for all of your images, then particles that don't come up with the correct orientations, you can actually throw away the bad ones. But I think that's probably a lot more work than it's worth, and it also means that you're degrading your data a little bit, and there's all sorts of arguments against it. But anyway, overall, the tilt validation scheme I highly endorse using. I think if you have any low-resolution structure and you have any uncertainty about whether you've got the correct structure, you should definitely do it. If you're doing an icosahedral virus, probably it's not strictly necessary. If you get structures and it looks like the projections and you've imposed 60-fold symmetry, you know, there's not a whole lot of doubt that the structure is correct. But you know, you can do it, and it doesn't really take all that much effort to do. Okay, next test. So the next test we did was, you know, very often I've seen this problem. You know, someone puts a paper out for review, and they did their refinement. They say they did an EMAN2 refinement of their structure, and then I get this email message from the author of the paper saying, "Yeah, I tried to publish my paper, and the referee said he didn't believe my structure, and I had to re-refine it in a different software package to prove that it was right." It doesn't really prove anything, of course, but nonetheless, it's reassuring if you can refine something completely independently in multiple software packages and show that you get the same answer out. So this is, and you can see these structures are a lot more low-pass filtered than the other structures, and these were all filtered so they have the same appearance. So we solved the structure in four different packages. We did EMAN1 too, but I didn't bother showing that one here. So we did four different structures here, and you can see that there are differences between them. But the overall shape, at least, agrees. And that's reassuring. Now, one thing we could do is we actually compute the cross-resolution between these structures. All the structures were done with all of the data, but we can compute an FSC between any pair of these structures. So we compared the EMAN2 structure to each of the other three, just so we didn't have a whole bunch of curves in the plot. This was actually the original FSC curve that we published in the paper. Okay, so you can see it's a relatively healthy-looking FSC curve. So, it doesn't go quite all the way to zero. It's a little bit above zero. And you say, well, there's a little bit of a masking artifact there. But, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, a referee looks at that and he says, well, yeah, okay, it looks all right. Right? I mean, there's nothing obviously wrong about it. And it said 9.5 angstrom resolution, so that's what we published, just like everyone else does. Okay, now here's the comparison between the models that you get from the four different software packages. It's not nothing, right? I mean, there's reasonable correlation between all of them out to at least sort of 30 angstrom resolution, but then they begin to fall off. And the EMAN2 versus Sparks is kind of the worst one, which is interesting since they use the same core libraries, right? It's sort of the worst comparison. And that's about 25 sort of angstroms. And then we've got the EMAN2 versus Imagic, and that one's a little bit better. The best one is actually the EMAN2 versus Relion. However, there's a caveat there. Since Relion wants to have a good starting model, we had to take the EMAN2 model and do the phase randomization thing that we do for the gold standard test and use that as an initial model. So it had a little bit of a starting hint. So there was some bias towards the EMAN2 structure in here. So, for what it's worth. So, you know, that comes out to, you know, maybe like 17 angstroms or something like that. Since these all used all of the data, I guess we probably should be using like the 0.33 criteria. Whatever. Okay, now what happens if we do the gold standard test on this data? And the answer, unfortunately, is it depends. So I've run this about 5 different times now using slightly different parameters and slightly different methods, and you get a variety of different curves out when you do it different ways. So I've shown here the sort of the two extremes, and the best case it was about 15 angstroms, and the worst case it was about 17 angstroms. Technically, I actually had one that was like 14 too, but I didn't really trust that one, so I didn't include that one here. So certainly that's a lot worse than 9.6 angstroms, and that's a pretty pronounced difference, because if you have 9.6, you're going to start looking at alpha helices pretty strongly, and if you have 15, you're going to say, well, my shape is right, but beyond that. So what's going on here? You already saw the data. I mean, the data is actually pretty strong, and this is a reasonably large structure. Calcium release channel is about 2.5 megadaltons, and this is about half the size. You know, it's about 1.3 megadaltons or something, so it's not a tiny structure. It's got the detergent there, which makes the background worse, but, you know, still. And the answer, at least part of the answer, is this. So if we compute a 3D variance map of the structure, it turns out there are actually really large motions, variability, going on inside this structure. Now, if I remember, yes, this is the APO form of the channel. Now, one of the problems with IP3 receptors is it has just a, how do I say this nicely, a bunch of ligands. I think it was something like 15 or 20 or something at the last count. It just has a tremendous number of ligands, and there's no possible way you can control them all. So we tried to strip off sort of all of them and leave it in just sort of an APO state in the membrane, and the hopes that that would be a fairly stable closed conformation. Well, it seems like it's closed, but it's not all that stable. And we can see this in a little bit more detail here with these little dynamics movies that I like to make. So we've got two different views here. And you can see here these sort of motions going on in these different class averages in the side view. And that represents something around 15 angstroms of motion. Now, some parts of the structure, if you look at the variance map, are a little bit more stable than others. And these helices that we think we were seeing in sort of the transmembrane domain, which seem to look like helices we've seen from other channels, I still think there may be a little something to that, even if the overall average resolution is only 15 angstroms. This part of the map is pretty stable, actually. Maybe there's something there. I wouldn't stake my career on it, though. This is pretty much what was going on, and this is why you're not getting a single stable structure. And you say, well, you could subclassify it. What if I break it down into several subpopulations? But this isn't just like a single, ligand bound or ligand not bound. This is really large scale, continuous, structural variability. I avoid the term heterogeneity because biochemists usually associate that with something that's falling apart or aggregating or doing something really bad. So structural variability is present in this map. And even if you subdivide it into several populations, it's really hard to limit it substantially. I mean, you could probably chop it up into 10 groups, and then maybe we could get down to sort of, 12 angstrom resolution instead of 15, but, it's not going to let us get to really high resolution. So the only solution to this problem is likely to find a biochemical state where we can really lock it down a little bit more tightly if we want to study it structurally. Or we could actually look at this and we could actually try and interpret some of the dynamics that we're seeing contextually. So, if you get lemons, you make lemonade. So, if you can't get a high resolution structure out of something, that may actually pay to do some variability analysis and see what else you can figure out. So we actually have a paper in preparation with all of this stuff in it, and it was supposed to go out 3 months ago. It'll probably go out any day now. I'll just say one word about the calcium release channel, because people then get suspicious and they say, well, you also claim 9.6 angstrom resolution for your calcium release channel structure. Maybe that's not right either. And you started interpreting all these putative helices in here and stuff like that. Well, when you do the gold standard test in calcium release channel, it's not quite as bad. It isn't 9.6, but it comes up to about 12 angstrom resolution if you do it on the calcium release channel. So 12 angstrom resolution is the point at which, if you have well-defined alpha helices, well-separated alpha helices, you will begin to see them. You can see it in Grohe-El. If you do Grohe-El at 12 angstrom resolution, you can see several places where you actually can begin to sort of resolve the helices. And that's basically exactly what we saw in this map, was we could start to see helices in some places, and they were, in some places, they looked reasonably well-defined. In other places, they were just these short little lumps, and they were kind of putative. So I think that really does agree better with what we were actually seeing in the map. So a little mea culpa on this one, which is we overestimated the resolution slightly, but not as dramatically. All right. So I want to finish the talk with this. What is this? This is the question, if we had collected the data that we used in the original IP3 receptor structure today, would we have known we shouldn't have processed that data and produced a structure from it? Part of the answer is yes, because if we take the data set, the actual boxed out particles from that original data set, and I refine them using these modern tools and modern gold standard test and variability test and all that sort of thing, we don't get a good structure out of it anymore. So software has definitely improved over the last N years, and I think we would not have made that same mistake if we had collected that same data today. But let's see if there's anything we can do quantitatively with the data. So I want to start with this sort of exploration. How do people typically evaluate their micrographs? Well, the first thing someone does when they get a micrograph is they take a Fourier transform of the micrograph, They look at the 2D power spectrum. They make sure they don't have a lot of astigmatism or drift. Then they do a 1D power spectrum, and they see how far out the tone rings go. Right? And that's pretty much what everyone does when they want to evaluate their data. And if you don't even do that, then you probably should learn. So if we do this on the whole micrograph, we get this nice-looking curve. And we can see in this particular data set, you can see signal going all the way out to sort of 7-ish, even a little, something, little ripples out here, you know, past 7 angstrom resolution, right? This was the new data set, not the old data set, by the way. You can see the curve looks kind of noisy, and that's because we've dramatically oversampled the thing. You know, we've done a 4K by 4K image, and we've taken an FFT of the whole thing, so we have 4,000 points in this curve. We don't really need that many. If we chop the image up into little pieces, and then average together the FFTs of the pieces, then we get less sampling, but we can get a smoother-looking power spectrum. So if we do that, now the curve looks a little bit nicer, and oh, very nice, so we can judge how far our data goes. Unfortunately, that's not the whole story. Okay, so what else could we do if we have a power spectrum like this? Well, one thing we could do is we can try and compute a signal-to-noise ratio from the power spectrum. How would we do that? Well, we were pretty convinced that these are actually zeros, you know, meaning that there's no signal present here. So we can actually just sort of fit a line through all the zeros and say that anything below the line is noise, and anything above the line is signal. And in a particular context, that's actually a valid statement. It's just interpreting signal as anything that has tone rings. Okay? That doesn't mean particles. That just means anything that has tone rings is signal. And we can do that. We can get a signal-to-noise ratio calculation for it. So that's just background subtracted. And we can compute a signal-to-noise ratio for... Oh, hang on. What are we looking at there? Let's just get that. We're going to look at the signal-to-noise ratio. So we compute the signal-to-noise ratio with this curve. What we see in this curve is the structure factor of whatever it is we're looking at multiplied by the contrast transfer function with additive noise. Okay? Now, the structure factor in this case is just a jumble. It's whatever happens to be in the background of our image. So it doesn't really have a whole lot of meaning. But we can use this as a basis for computing the signal-to-noise ratio as the measured signal, the total curve, minus the noise divided by the noise. And that will give us some estimate. And we can compute that. We can look at it. Those little ripples, we can actually see that the little ripples are actually pretty significant. And if we actually overlay a CTF, I don't think I do that, but if you actually overlay sort of a CTF pattern on this, you can actually see that those ripples are in the right place, and you have the data going out to high resolution. This was collected on a good microscope, though, so we expect to have some signal going out to high resolution. So it looks like our signal-to-noise ratio peaks somewhere a little bit above 1, and then it falls off fairly rapidly, but not super rapidly with resolution. It's still at like 0.6 here at about 18 angstroms. You know, if we looked at this data, we should have said, you should be able to process this data out past 10 angstrom resolution. All right, so let's keep going. Now let's compare the two data sets using this methodology. So we see on the left is the raw data from the old structure, and on the right, the raw data from the new structure. And we're going to use what I just showed you on each data set separately, and you compute these signal-to-noise ratio curves. Now, the old data set was collected on a really crappy microscope. No offense to the old microscope, but... So it falls off much, much more rapidly. You know, we don't have any data out to 10 angstroms clearly in this data, but we never claimed to have data out to 10 angstroms in this data. It seems to have very good signal, right? The peak signal-to-noise ratio here and here are almost identical. If I overlay the two curves, I thought I overlaid the two curves. I guess I don't. If you overlay these two curves, they match extremely well. However, there's sort of a problem with this whole methodology, right? I mentioned this. The structure factor was actually just whatever was randomly in your background, and that's true, but that's not what we're analyzing. That's not the structure that we're trying to solve. And we also have this problem with the noise. We're sort of assuming that anything that has tone rings is signal, and anything that doesn't have tone rings is noise. Well, it could be that there's other things in your image that'll produce tone rings that aren't noise. So, rather than using just boxed out regions of your micrograph, we're going to use particles as the basis for our power spectrum analysis now. So we box out all of our particles, and then we box out all regions of noise from the image, and we use the power spectrum from the red curves for background, and we use the power spectrum from the white curves to be signal plus noise. Okay, so this isn't the white boxes aren't going to give you just signal, they're going to give you signal plus noise, and the red curves would give you background. This is actually very much analogous to what you might do in, say, a spectroscopy experiment where you put a blank buffer in. right? It's just that, you know, we can't make a good blank grid for cryo-EM because you can never get the ice thickness the same or the conditions the same. But if we pick out regions where we don't see any particles, that can be our sort of blank for background subtraction. Okay, the problem is if we try to use that method on data like this, we can't find enough blank regions in the image to actually get enough data to make a nice power spectrum. So if you want this to work well, you have to have about the same number of particles of background as you have particles of signal, of particle. Otherwise, your curves are going to get really noisy and it's going to be terrible. So that method turns out not to be very practical in most situations. So we came up with this solution, which I think is at least a little bit clever. We've been using it in EMAN for the last 5 years or so. No, I still haven't published it. I have this big paper that I've been writing for the last 5 years, which I still haven't managed to put out. But anyway, I'll just tell you about it. So the idea is the edges of the images have pretty good background in them, and the centers of the image have pretty good particles and don't have a whole lot of background. So what we're going to do is we're going to mask out the middle of each image, and we're going to mask out the outside of each image using sort of the inverse mask with also a little bit of apodization on the edge, and get this. Okay? Now, this isn't pure particle, and this isn't pure noise, but it's sort of close enough for approximation. In EMAN 2, we sort of recommended, as compared to EMAN 1, that you use bigger box sizes than you used historically, and that helps with CTF correction and helps give us these better backgrounds. Now, you can also have to ask the question, well, what if your particles are too close together and you get edges of other particles sticking into your boxes? And that is a perturbation. It does, you know, if you have an edge of a particle sticking in your edge of your box here, that'll contribute incorrectly to the power spectrum of the background a little bit. But unless you've got particles cramming in on every single side, it's not going to be a really major effect. And the worst thing it will do is make you underestimate your signal-to-noise ratio. That effect will never allow you to overestimate what you have in your image. It will always make your signal-to-noise ratio worse. Okay, so I think that's probably a good thing rather than a bad thing. Okay, so we box out all of these, and we box out all of these, and we compute the power spectrum from each, and when we look at that, okay, so here's the power spectrum from the black boxes, and then there's the power spectrum from the edges. And you can see it's quite a lot different than that in this particular case. So all of the stuff between this curve and this curve, not only were we not treating it as noise, we were treating it as signal. So we get this sort of double whammy. So we're massively overestimating our signal-to-noise ratio if we use just the sort of fit-through-the-zeros approach. Now, the fit-through-the-zeros approach is great if you're trying to assess how well your microscope is performing, but it's not great if you're trying to assess how good your particle data is. Okay, so now let's take a look at how these new signal-to-noise ratio curves turn out. So this is the signal-to-noise ratio curve for the new structure using the new data, and you can see, now that we have our structure factor taken into account properly, we actually have really nice, you know, a signal-to-noise ratio of 2 or 3 in these low-resolution peaks, which represent the quaternary structure of the channel, and we have this nice signal out to pretty high resolution, so it looks very nice. What if what happens with the old data? This was what we got using the other method. This isn't the old data. This is the new data done using the overall micrograph method. You can see it overestimates the signal-to-noise ratio in the intermediate regime here and actually all the way out to fairly high resolution, but it underestimates it dramatically at low resolution. Okay. Here's what we get for the old data. Okay, the old data, with the old method of estimation, we had this big peak here where we said the signal-to-noise ratio was just as good as it was before. Now when we estimate it by particle, you can see the signal-to-noise ratio actually peaks at about 0.2, and this region here where we expected to see all this quaternary structure, which we were going to use for our low-resolution alignments of the particles, there's almost nothing there. So if you look at this data like this, you would say, maybe I should go back to the wet lab again and try harder. So what's going on here is detergent, continuous carbon, probably the ice was a little too thick. There's all sorts of things that can cause these effects. But this allows you to sort of assess it quantitatively. And since I sort of realized that this was true in this data set, I've gone back and I've looked at about 20 of the projects that we've published in recent years and actually tried to assess some of the data in cases where we could analyze it and we couldn't analyze it very well. And it turns out to work as a very good assessment for your data. If the signal-to-noise ratio in this sort of structure factor regime here, so if the signal-to-noise ratio in this sort of regime below, say, 50 angstroms or 30 angstroms peaks somewhere above you know, about 0.5 to 0.7. So if it peaks somewhere up here, then you can definitely analyze the data. If it never exceeds 0.5, you almost certainly cannot analyze the data. Yeah?
I wonder if you apply this way to images, which is taking like much lower defocus, because people always try to use lower defocus together. Then your particle became much harder to...
You're absolutely right, and that has the effect of damping that down, absolutely. And I would say that this actually does give you a threshold below which you can't analyze that close-to-focus data reliably anymore. Now, the problem is it's not a really hard threshold. It's a somewhat soft threshold. I would say, you know, if it's above 1, everything's great. If it's below 0.5, it's definitely bad. If it's somewhere between 0.5 and 1, then maybe it's okay, maybe it's not okay, and I can't, you know, you can't get an absolutely concrete answer. I would say if it's a high symmetry particle and you're going to impose, you know, if you're going to impose 60-fold symmetry or something, that gives you some effective magnification of the signal-to-noise ratio, and you could probably tolerate slightly lower values here. If it's a completely asymmetric particle and the mass is low and stuff like that, then maybe you can't. But as sort of a general diagnostic, you can see in this particular case. All right, let's go to the end here. So this was the comparison we did originally when we did the whole micrographs, and you could see you couldn't tell the difference between them in that test. And now, if we overlay the two, you can see that it's just completely night and day, right? I mean, the new data is just dramatically better than the old data. And I'm just showing this one last example here to say that you don't always have strongly scattering backgrounds. When you have detergent in the buffer or if you have continuous carbon, then obviously you can get a lot of tone rings from that. This was an argument that Bob and Powell and I had like 5 years ago. I said, well, you know, background doesn't scatter much at all. We don't get tone rings off that. And Powell said, what are you talking about? You get lots of tone rings off the background. The answer is it can be either. If you have detergent or you have some large buffer molecule sitting in the background, it will scatter and produce tone rings. But pure water or salt water does not produce tone rings, or at least not a measurable amount of tone rings. Presumably, that's because it's still basically a liquid. It's just it's a glass, right? It's not moving very fast, but it's moving fast enough to destroy the coherence. At least that's my interpretation. So that's about it. So conclusions: gold standard FSCs. You have to do it. I think there's no way around it. Any paper I review right now, if they don't start doing gold standard FSC now, I will reject it. I hope other people will probably follow suit with that kind of thing. If you're using EMAN2, there's a tool for computing it. If you're using Relion, there's tools for computing it. Nico has some way of doing something equivalent, right?
No, forever,
yeah, right. It's certainly possible to do, and you can do it manually in any package. I think tilt validation is a very good idea, and particularly important if you're doing something low resolution and you know something small that you haven't ever seen before. And we've got the signal-to-noise ratio method for analysis. And I'll just remind everyone that there will be a little EMAN2 discussion at 3 p.m., I think, in this room later.